This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell is running for mayor. After hinting at the decision last week, Councilor Campbell, whose district includes parts of Dorchester, Mattapan, Roslindale, and Jamaica Plain, made the decision official in a video released this morning. She's out on the campaign trail today, but joins us now on the phone. Councilor Campbell, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So you have a powerful life story, and you made it front and center in your announcement. Mayor Walsh has made his biography a key point in his campaigns. Michelle Wu is doing so now. How important is who you are in this race, and why do you think your life path makes you the right fit as Boston's next mayor?
I think it's extremely important. You know, when I first ran for office, I talked about losing my twin brother, Andre, who passed away at the age of 29 while in the custody of the Department of Correction, which oversees our prisons here in Massachusetts. He had scleroderma and, as a result of receiving inadequate health care, passed away. And I asked one question, which is, how did two twins born and raised in the city of Boston have such different life outcomes? That was a question that fueled my run for council in the first place. It continues to inform the work. But I also know it was a story that that many folks could relate to, that inspired many. And being born and raised in the city of Boston and a product of Boston Public Schools, I find that when I continue to share more pieces of my story, it inspires others to do the same. And so now I look forward to running for mayor, not only to share a story, of course, to listen to others share theirs, but to work on dismantling systems that perpetuate inequities in the city of Boston.
You know, that calls to mind last night after a grand jury in Kentucky didn't charge any officers with killing Breonna Taylor in her apartment. You tweeted out, quote, "I don't want to hear Boston is better than that," end quote. What do you want to hear and what do you want to see?
So I love the city of Boston and I take tremendous pride in being born and raised here. My father was also born and raised in the city of Boston. It is where I've received every opportunity that you can imagine, a good education, after-school program, jobs, you name it, to be successful. But I also have had a lot of pain here. And I also know that Boston, unfortunately, is considered one of the most profoundly unequal cities in this country. And so I think this is a unique opportunity for us to look at our own painful history with respect to racism and division, to confront it head-on as a city, and to do it together, and also, of course, to eradicate inequities so that every person in the city of Boston feels as though the city is working for them, too.
What is something that Boston's mayor could do right now to start eradicating those inequities?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, when I first, you know, got to the council, I focused on criminal justice reform and reentry programming. I focused on improving access to our education system and improving or expanding the number of quality schools in the city of Boston, put out action plans on that, expanding diversity with respect to public safety agencies, looking at every single issue in the city of Boston through a racial equity lens, got funding to bring the city council through that when I was council president. So there's so much, but I think much of what I tend to see in constituents as well is plans for rhetoric, but not enough action. And we need action immediately to dismantle systems that continue to create inequities in healthcare, in education, access to green space, good housing, good jobs, and so much more.
So the Boston Police Reform Task Force is recommending a variety of changes to the city's police force, including creation of an independent office with broad investigatory and subpoena powers, expanding the use of body cameras. Mayor Walsh created that task force this summer, and he said he's committed to taking action on their recommendations. Would you do the same?
Absolutely. I have applauded the work of all who served on the task force. They've done excellent work, and they do excellent work in the community. For me, though, the recommendations are a start, but need to go farther. And so I have been pushing, of course, for the adoption of a civilian review board. But folks before me, including my predecessor, Councilor Yancey, and so many others, have been pushing for that for decades. Folks have been pushing for us to diversify our public safety agencies, bring in more women and people of color for decades. Folks have been pushing us to look at the inequities within our policing, the fact that we just got the stop and frisk data that says, you know, over 70% of police stops were Black residents, even though they only make up a quarter of the population of the city of Boston. So there's a lot more that we can do. It's great that he has a task force, but I've been encouraging him not only to adopt their recommendations, but he has to, of course, take action. We've seen a lot of reports in the past. We need action.
So let's stay with Mayor Walsh for a minute. He hasn't said whether he's going to run again or not. It is true he has received high marks for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. I want to ask you, do you feel that Marty Walsh has handled the pandemic well?
I first of all, I want to say, you know, I know the mayor loves the city of Boston just as much as I do. We have been very intentional in working in partnership, especially when it comes to the pandemic, the council working in partnership with the administration and vice versa. This pandemic is new for all of us. I think the part that is missing or often lost in the conversation is how communities of color are doing. They are disproportionately being hit by this pandemic in ways that are unimaginable, dying at higher rates. The infection rates are higher in communities of color all across the city of Boston. I represent a district that is predominantly a district of color. And so there needs to be greater intentionality with respect to those communities of color in every conversation with respect to the pandemic. And that's what I've been pushing.
What's one thing the city could or should have had done differently in these first several months of the pandemic to better support communities of color?
Well, I will tell you, you know, there are coalitions across the city of Boston, including the Black Boston Coalition run by Priscilla Flint Banks, that have been pushing for communities of color to have greater access to testing and rapid testing. You know, we have folks still who are going to get tested and only are getting their results back after several days or over a week, which is way too long. This coalition is also pushing for us to not only have an equity lens so that we understand that everything we roll out with respect to the pandemic across the city of Boston, that we might have to have greater intentionality in communities of color because of the longstanding health disparities in those communities, which are being exacerbated by this pandemic. And so we just have to be much more intentional with respect to testing, resources, and so much more. I think we're doing better now, but it was slow to start with.
Last question, in a sentence, it's hard to unseat an incumbent mayor in Boston. Why do you think now is the time?
Well, I will tell you, you know, I ran for office the first time and I challenged an incumbent. And not to suggest that he wasn't doing a great job, we just came with different perspectives and a different story. In this race for mayor, I'm going to bring a different story and different perspective, and I'm looking forward to building a grassroots campaign and introducing myself to voters all across the city of Boston.
That is Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It was good to have you. Listening into that conversation was Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker. Adrian, welcome back.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, Adrian, and I'll just ask you to start with your reactions to what we just heard from Andrea Campbell.
I think she laid out, you know, kind of what this campaign is going to be about, and especially the way it's going to be shaped by the whole issue of coronavirus, which has, you know, put every inequality front and center. So we're going to, you know, whether we're talking about health care, schools, or a host of other issues. So that's what we're going to be hearing a lot about over the next year.
Any reason to think that Marty Walsh won't run again? You wrote back in May, quote, make no mistake, Walsh fully intends to run again, but he hasn't declared.
I firmly believe he's running. I don't think it means anything that he hasn't, quote unquote, declared. I don't think he's waiting on a job in the Biden administration. I don't think that's true. I would bet serious money that the mayor will be on the ballot next September.
So if that's the case, now we have a possibility that you've got a race with Andrea Campbell and Michelle Wu, who might strip support from each other's candidacies. Two progressive challengers, women of color, and they're running against a popular, well-financed incumbent with the incumbent history we know Boston has. Now, it might not necessarily play out that way, but it could. Do you think they might hurt each other's chances, that the two of them in the race and maybe others strengthen Marty Walsh's chances of winning again?
I mean, I think you got to remember the structure of the race, which is that it's not a sort of a partisan primary where they will hurt each other. One of them will end up probably in a final against the mayor, right? Because it's highly unlikely that he'll finish third. So, you know, I think the idea is that one of them will get a chance to run against him one-on-one, and we'll see what happens.
You know, it seems like there is a lot of energy in this mayor's race to me. It actually feels a little more like when the seat was open than when Councillor Tito Jackson challenged Walsh. Does the energy feel higher to you, too? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, it feels higher. It feels higher because we're in the middle of so much. You know, we're in the middle of a huge social justice movement and a pandemic. You know, there wasn't anything like that when Councillor Jackson was running against Mayor Walsh. So certainly we're in a much more intense political period.
Adrian, in that column back in May that you wrote that I mentioned, you were talking about how hard it might be to challenge Marty Walsh because of his high marks on the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. A lot has happened since May, including the racial reckoning you mentioned. Would you make the same argument today?
Yes, I would make the same. But look, the history is serious here, okay? Amir hasn't lost in 70 years, and it's not an accident. He's got more money than they were raised put together already. He's got, obviously, 100% name recognition, and he's a popular mayor. I mean, they are formidable candidates, and I'm not taking anything away from them. But we shouldn't underestimate how difficult this race will be for them.
So let's stay with the formidable candidates. What's the strongest case for each challenger, Wu and Campbell, about why they should be mayor?
Councilor Wu has spent years positioning herself as the voice of the left in the city, and, you know, her strongest argument will be that she would be the greatest break from the status quo and that she is the true voice of change. I think Councilor Campbell will run based on her strong work in education, her biography in the city, and also on the issue of police reform. But I think in relative terms, she is the more moderate of the two candidates. So in a sense, you know, she is sort of the candidate in between Walsh and Wu.
And what do you think Walsh's best case for why he stays in office is at this point?
Walsh's best case for why he stays in office is that he has had two fairly successful terms as mayor. I think people think that he has guided the city through the virus very effectively. I think that's probably been his strongest moment as mayor. And I think his strongest argument will be that there isn't a strong case for change at this point.
So, Adrian, I am struck by how much has changed in this city in this last couple of years, this incredibly diverse city council that we have now. Two women of color from that city council challenging a white incumbent mayor in a time of national reckoning on race. I wonder, one, is this the cycle where maybe Boston elects a mayor who's not a white man? And either way, what does this moment that we're seeing in this race tell you about how the city is changing?
Well, we're going to see how much it tells us about how much the city has changed. And certainly, we're in a moment of great change. And as you say, you can point to the council to see that. So, it's certainly going to be a different race than the race between Walsh and Tito Jackson 4 years ago. But we should remember that Jackson ran on many of the same ideas that Wu and Campbell are running on and lost 2-1. So it'll be interesting to see just how much it's changed. The one thing that has not changed dramatically is the electorate, you know, or the makeup of the electorate. You know, in order for one of them to beat Mayor Walsh, what they're going to have to do is really expand the people who vote. It's going to take a bigger turnout and a much bigger turnout among people of color. And we'll see if either of these candidates can inspire that.
And what are you watching for in the next couple of weeks or months? Anything you particularly are looking for?
I don't think we're going to see a ton in the next couple of months, which is largely going to be a time for them to get organized and to begin their fundraising and so forth. And, of course, for the mayor to decide whether he's wanting it to officially get in. So the next couple of months will be dominated, unfortunately, by presidential politics. But I think this race will get really interesting right after the first of the year.
Well, that is Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker. Adrian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
16 Massachusetts school districts with low coronavirus infection rates are in the hot seat to get kids back in school in person. Here is Governor Charlie Baker this afternoon.
We think kids should be in school, and we think communities should be following the rules and the guidance that was developed by the department and using the district-by-district data that's now been available to people since the beginning of August.
So that all follows a letter that the Commissioner of Secondary and Elementary Education, Jeff Riley, sent to the districts threatening an audit if they didn't submit plans to that end by next week. Now, in a minute, we're going to hear from the superintendent of one of those 16 communities. But first, we want to get the latest from WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So it is no secret, Max, that Governor Baker wants kids back in school where possible. And he and Jeff Riley have been pushing districts, particularly ones with these lowest positivity rates or in the green on the map, to bring students back in person. Tell us a little more about this letter to the 16 districts. What's it asking for? Why these 16?
Well, the letter is primarily asking for information, Tiziana, namely Why are you, these districts, starting the year remotely if you've been judged low risk? But I'm going to go with a metaphor out of my beat, I guess, and say it was a little like a teacher cold calling a student who she thinks isn't paying attention. It's a question, but it's got this kind of edge to it. There are bold sections in the letter. It says there's a stark disparity or stark discrepancy between your plans and the state recommendations. And then Riley asked districts, gave them this ultimatum, explain your thinking within 10 days. And then he invoked a possible audit if he doesn't like the answers. As to why these communities were chosen, they're sort of all over the state. There isn't necessarily a pattern, except this unifying factor that you mentioned. They're starting remote, and they have been color-coded as low-risk, green, or gray since the color-coding system was rolled out now 7 weeks ago.
So Jeff Riley spoke at the State House this afternoon. What did he say about, you mentioned the audit. What did he say about this threat of the audit for these communities? What does that even look like?
Yeah, I think everyone's proceeding pretty cautiously here. Riley, I think, has tried to soften the letter's implications a little bit since it was sent. He told us a few days ago, this is not a threat, he said. And today he sounded kind of a similar note. We're giving school committees time to respond, and it's still unclear whether and when we'll need to escalate, what that'll look like. But Tiziana, he did explain what was meant by that kind of scary word, audit. Let's hear that.
It's two things, right? It's a focus on what's happening remotely and what that looks like, what the instruction looks like, instructional hours, things like that. But it also looks at the entirety of the district, from our special education students being served, second language learners, what's the quality of the curriculum. It's kind of a soup to nuts audit is what that is.
So the issue here, Tiziana, is, of course, that the state doesn't directly control education in a given district, right? That goes down to the local officials. But they do shape curriculum, set schedules, and serve to guarantee the rights of students with disabilities to an appropriate public education. So I guess you could expect this audit to look into whether those needs are being met during a period of remote learning.
So this didn't just, you know, come, although it kind of sounds like it did come out of the blue, but there has to be a basis for the push that the governor and that Riley are making. What is that basis?
Well, I think it would be that the governor and Commissioner Riley fear that those ordinary needs of students aren't being met. They might worry about learning loss. They're very proud of the state's first in the nation test scores and just generally the education level in this state. They might also worry about lawsuits, especially from families of students with disabilities who might be being underserved under a remote paradigm. And then I think there's a will to just keep pushing the state, Tiziana, in the direction of a safe reopening on multiple fronts and all at the same time. For instance, Baker was asked about the move to hurry up the physical reopening of schools, which he did even as he relaxed restrictions on capacity in bars and restaurants. A reporter asked, don't those moves work against one another? And here's what he said.
Part of the reason we made the change with respect to restaurants was because we talk all the time to the governors around the rest of the Northeast, and they made pretty clear to us that their current operating model had not proven to be a significant threat to the public health. So we adopted it. But I don't see those as in competition with each other. I don't see them as in conflict with each other. We think kids should be in school.
So Max, I gotta assume that there's pushback. Is there, and is it from teachers? Is it from the districts?
Yeah, on both fronts, there seems to be an irritation this week. Go districts first. I spoke to a number of school committee members who feel like the Baker administration is trying to have it both ways. They keep saying they respect local decision making, but then they're kind of trying to undermine those decisions on the side when they don't like the result. And then Mary Najimy, who's the president of the Mass Teachers Association, the biggest teachers union in the state, used a loaded word of her own. She said Baker's trying to bully districts into returning in person. Baker was asked about Najimy's remark this afternoon and replied.
When most people in the education and the public health and the pediatric community all believe that in-person learning, especially for young kids, is a critical part of their educational and social development, we want to know what your plan is to get back. I don't think that's bullying. I think it's a perfectly appropriate question to ask on behalf of the people of those communities, and especially the kids.
I want to say, I do think the governor's painting with maybe too broad a brush there. It's true that most people, doctors and educators, will say, yeah, it's urgent to get students, especially young students, back in classrooms as soon as it's safe. but they disagree about whether it's safe now because the virus has manifested in so many different ways in different places. And then teachers want to remind parents and families that in-person learning is going to be really different this year, this fall, most of all, more anxious, less comfortable, and inevitably less safe than staying at home. And then some people in the world of public health aren't convinced about the state plan. I spoke to Carlene Pavlos, who's head of the Mass Public Health Association. Yesterday, the governor, I guess erroneously, said the group had helped shape his plan for reopening. In fact, they didn't do that, and they don't even endorse it. Pavlos says that using one single variable, this color code, to determine what cities and towns should do for their schools is, quote, wholly inappropriate.
All right, Max, I'm going to ask you to stand by, thanks, because I want to bring in the voice of a superintendent from one of the communities affected by this. That's Watertown, and Superintendent D.D. Galdston is joining us. Superintendent Galdston, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So why is Watertown included on this list of 16 communities? Because it is my understanding that your town does have a plan to return students to a hybrid model. You're just not there yet.
Right. So I wonder a little bit myself about how it is that we made the list, but apparently it was due to the fact that we were planning to return to a hybrid model in the end of October, which seemed to be not soon enough.
So do you feel bullied by the administration? We heard that quote earlier when Max Larkin, our reporter, was talking.
I don't necessarily feel bullied by the administration. I just wonder about the being singled out when I do know that, you know, roughly 30% of districts are starting remote, and many of them are gray or green and did not receive a similar letter. So, again, I don't feel bullied. I just wonder about how in-depth they really realize the plan that we've put in place in Watertown, and that we are definitely moving towards hybrid learning.
You know, in watching this, it sometimes looks as if districts are stuck between a rock and a hard place, facing pressure from teachers and teachers' unions on one side, facing pressure from the state and the administration on the other side. Are you in between a rock and a hard place here?
I think that I don't know if I feel like I'm in between a rock and a hard place. I would say that here in Watertown, you know, we worked diligently beginning in May with a very large task force of 74 people, including our teachers and representatives from our union and parents and administration, and really spent a lot of time putting together the plan. So I don't feel stuck between the two. You know, I think that we received the message pretty clearly that we were trying, you know, we were supposed to do what we thought was best for our community, and I think that we did that, and so I do feel that I think we honored both. We honored the guidance from the state as well as our local community's desires for a gradual reopening of schools.
And what are you hearing from parents and students?
So right now it's fairly quiet on the parent front, and I think, again, that if I had to guess why that is, I think it's because of the fact that we were so transparent in our process. And I think that in August, yes, there were people who didn't necessarily understand the direction that we were going in. But I certainly believe that we provided a lot of opportunities for feedback, input, and comments from our parents and our community. And I think that, you know, right now we have a plan and people know what it is. And I think that we're getting going. And I just wanted to add, you know, we did open on the 22nd. We were actually a little bit later than the other districts. And we have all of our, you know, high-need students coming in over the course of the next couple of days. So we started already with students in person, and we believe that we're going to be able to meet our students' needs.
D.D. Galdston is superintendent of the Watertown Public Schools. I know this is a busy time, so thanks very much for joining us today.
Of course, absolutely.
So I want to return to WBUR reporter Max Larkin. Max, I want to invite you to start by just reacting to what you just heard from Superintendent Galdston.
Yeah, I think she really spoke for this whole cohort of districts and their leadership. I think there's not necessarily a sense of being victimized or bullied, but they are confused. You had Baker and Riley saying all summer that local control of school districts was going to rule the day, whether they liked it or not. districts, I think, took that pretty seriously. And now that they seem to be being criticized from Beacon Hill and from Malden, where Riley's office is, they're sort of wondering what those state leaders meant.
Max, I feel like in the call-in segments that we've done on Radio Boston, the coverage over the last several months, there's just been so much tension, so much disagreement, a lot of positions taken by families and parents and teachers and unions and superintendents. I admit in what I'm hearing here and what we heard from the superintendent, it sounds much more measured. Are we in a better place than it seems like we are?
That is a very good question. I mean, I think the reason, to sort of take a little detour, the reason we have local control of school districts, and there are problems with it, to be sure, but the reason we do that is because there are granular realities on the ground that it's easier for a school committee, you know, sitting a few blocks away to notice than it is for state or national officials. And yes, in some ways we are in a better place. And I think in general, districts are making decisions that reflect that reality. So you heard in Watertown, they've got some students, you know, plan to go hybrid. In Amesbury, another letter recipient, they've got students with disabilities in school for half days, 4 days a week. We're cautiously, tentatively moving toward a world in which better educational models are delivered safely. It's just we don't yet know what this winter will look like. So I think an amount of caution is warranted, right?
Yeah, that is WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, it's satisfying to continue to follow this with you and sort of build the picture as we go. I hope we'll be able to continue to do that.
Yeah, anytime.
Thanks, Max. And much of the nation is reeling today from the news that the officers who killed 26-year-old Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky this spring will not be charged for that. Taylor was shot and killed by police during a raid on her apartment in March, and a grand jury indicted a former Louisville detective for wanton endangerment for his actions during the raid. But no charges were announced against the other two officers who fired shots, six of which led to Taylor's death. Here in Boston, demonstrators gathered for a rally in Franklin Park.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No racist!
Police!
No justice!
No peace!
And here's local activist Monica Cannon Grant, who organized the rally.
Today we got bad news. I think for a lot of the Black community, though, it wasn't a surprise. We're just disappointed.
And during a press conference today, Governor Charlie Baker called what happened to Breonna Taylor a terrible tragedy.
Unfortunately, in our country, too many tragedies like this befall people of color and far too often. I think everybody appreciates the pain and the loss being felt and suffered by her family and her loved ones during this incredibly unimaginable time.
So many people reflecting, and so today we are taking stock of how our city and our Commonwealth is reacting to the news, and we want to give you a chance to share how you're feeling. What is your reaction to the Breonna Taylor news, especially after a summer full of protest and unrest around policing in this country? Did it surprise you, or did you somewhat expect it? Where do you think things go from here? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two guests joining us for the conversation. First is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe, joins us on the line. Renee, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Renee. Thanks for being here. And also with us is Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP. He now works with the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and is also a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Hey, glad to be here, Tiziana.
And Renee, I'll start with you. Where are your heart and your head today?
You know, it's just about 24 hours now, and, you know, I'm as I've been so many times this year, I'm really exhausted. You know, I'm horrified by the decision. I'm disgusted, but I'm not at all surprised. You know, this was a disgrace and atrocity. You know, Breonna Taylor's been dead for more than 6 months, and the men who killed her will never see the inside of a prison cell for shooting her to death in her own apartment. I don't even know how to make sense of this. except to look at the fact that it continually happens. And I found it especially poignant yesterday that, you know, it was September 23rd, which was also the 65th anniversary of the verdict that acquitted the two men who killed Emmett Till in 1955 in Mississippi. He was a 14-year-old black teenager from Chicago who was visiting relatives in Mississippi and was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered and dumped in the river. And, you know, the fact that on that 65th anniversary, you know, here was the black community again, black America one more time, getting no justice again, is just the most sinking and sickening feeling.
Michael, I'm just going to invite you to add your voice.
You know, I use a term often that researchers use of being weathered. Weathered being when you get used to something that's not normal, that's not healthy, but you get used to it. And I think many Americans, particularly black Americans, have become weathered to the outcomes in these cases. Most of the officers are not held accountable. People point to the civil side as if that's a some resolution for a family that lost a loved one. And there's no accountability for officers who take lives or who just violate the rights of African Americans. This is not new. And if we allowed ourselves to get overwhelmed by every case, it would be torturous for us. And I think about George Zimmerman and how I had a youth program in the NAACP at the time, and I had them debate whether I split the room up and made half the room argue for George Zimmerman's defense and the other half of the room argue for his conviction. And I did that for a reason, which is I wanted them to understand our legal process that often results in these folks not being held accountable. We got to understand it. And unfortunately, it's how our system works. I was not surprised in this case, and I don't think many attorneys were.
You know, I want to say we talk about the lack of accountability. Let's put then in context the charges that were incurred against the former detective, Hankison, for wanton endangerment, for firing shots in the apartment that threatened essentially neighbors. Where do you put that indictment in this landscape? And Renee, I'll start with you.
I think the fact that they came back with this charge of wanton endangerment was almost really adding insult to the very deep injury. And it, in the sense that a wall that got pierced by a bullet got more legal redress than a black woman shot to death by the police in her own bed. And I guess if all the bullets had hit Breonna Taylor, there wouldn't have been any charges at all. You know, and I think that, you know, Michael made an interesting point when he was sort of talking about these multi-million dollar settlements, and Breonna Taylor's family got a $12 million settlement from the city last week. And, you know, but money isn't justice. It's not justice for Breonna Taylor the same way it wasn't justice for Eric Garner or Tamir Rice or Michael Brown or Rekia Boyd or so many others who've been killed, you know, in the last decade or so. Those money's paid by taxpayers and not, say, police pensions. So there is no accountability, or the kind at least that fosters real sweeping change.
I just want to put the number out, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'd like to take a call. We have Kathleen on the line from Falmouth. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling mostly because I'm calling because, can you hear me?
Yeah. Kathleen, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm calling because my son works for Boston EMS, and this weekend on Saturday, they are burying a black female EMT who is considered an active duty death in the city of Boston. And I feel like I haven't heard anything about Regina. And I certainly want her honored for her work with Boston EMS. It doesn't have to do with a police shooting, and it doesn't have to do with, you know, poor care. But it does have to do with, you know, her being a first responder here and actually contracting COVID. And it wasn't a COVID death per se, but I'm just kind of astounded. I feel like if she was a white EMT, I just feel like I would hear it on the news. Maybe I'm
Thanks
wrong.
For that. Thanks for that, Kathleen. Let me give Michael Curry a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, you know, I think, again, it's the broader conversation about racism and how it manifests in our society. There are black businesses that don't get the attention they should. There are black deaths and from a myriad of reasons that doesn't get the attention it deserves or the recognition it deserves. That is racism, right? It manifests itself in so many parts of our society. Specific to Breonna Taylor, though, I want folks to think about how our system works, right? There is often no justice in these cases. And if we know our system, right? I always say that if this was a young white boy and a group of black officers or just a group of officers, it doesn't have to be black, had walked into the wrong apartment or with very speculative or tenuous information that granted a warrant signed by a judge, had walked in and killed someone, and it turned out there were no drugs found, no guns found, there was no crime committed, and it was some relationship she had with an ex-boyfriend or ex-friend or friend. The white community or that community at large would be upset and angry, and they would vote differently. They would be using their power, their leverage to make change. And in this case, the young black woman, which raises the question, do black lives matter? Because if you're a white person sitting anywhere in the Commonwealth right now or in New England, and the Breonna Taylor murder seems like collateral damage to you, then you don't get it. Black lives should matter to you, and you should be just as upset as that family.
Renee, in listening to Michael, it makes me think of the piece that you wrote, I want to say it was about 4 weeks ago now, where you talked about the drop-off of white people's attention to racism and polling about white people in our community saying whether it still matters after high levels of attention and intensity in June. And that just really resonates given what Michael just said.
Well, you know, you look at some of the protests that have come after the decision around the Breonna Taylor case. And you want to ask, where are you now? You know, where are all the white people? A lot of comment was made back in June after George Floyd was killed about, you know, how diverse the groups were and how diverse the protesters were. Where is it now? You know, where are those same people? Those same people who, you know, ran out and did all these great performative things like put Black Lives Matter signs up in their windows and get their bumper stickers. Where are they now? You know, what I never understand when these cases happen is, why isn't there more national outrage outside of communities of color? Everyone should be upset about this. Everyone should be concerned that too many police officers have a shoot first, ask questions later, if they ask questions at all. And I never get the sense of that. There's no reason why Black America should have to bear the burden of this alone. This should be outrageous to everyone. But again, we see the people who are, you know, the most affected are really the only ones, with some exceptions, who tend to react. You know, it makes me feel like what we saw in June was really much more of a mirage than some sort of a sea change.
I want to ask Michael and Renee if you'll sit tight for a second, because I want to do a call out to another voice here, who is Hoden Hashi. She's with the organization Black Boston, which represents the voices of young people of color. And this summer, she co-organized a march protesting police brutality that drew thousands. Hoden, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hello. Thank you for having me again.
Hoden, I just want to ask you how you're reacting today.
Yeah, I feel like I can kind of just echo a lot of what has already been said. It's an overwhelming feeling of being extremely disappointed while also not necessarily being surprised. I feel like a lot of people my age can kind of agree that we've grown up in a climate where, one, things like this are happening time and time and again. It feels like it's happening every single year at this point. And just, you know, with the existence of social media now, it is quite literally at our fingertips. So it's not a feeling that is easily escapable, and it can be all-consuming in a lot of ways. So I'm definitely just feeling a lot of that today.
Hoden, I want to play a bit of sound for you from Monica Cannon Grant, who organized last night's demonstration in Franklin Park. Here she is. Yeah.
Black women are dying at the hands of police. Black women are dying in healthcare. Black women are dying in education. We're dying across the board.
And we're basically saying, stop killing us.
You are a young Black woman. How are you holding it together?
It's definitely been difficult, if I'm being completely honest. I feel like there's a lot of different layers to what is kind of going on in my head at the moment. I kind of started the work that I've been doing this summer with two other Black women that were my age. And, you know, a big reason why we do what we do is because of what happened to Breonna Taylor. On top of, you know, the conversation of racism in America, there's also the conversation of misogyny in this country. And Black women kind of, you know, are on the losing end of both of those spectrums. So it can be very discouraging to kind of think about it from that perspective, while still being, you know, at the forefront of starting these conversations. I feel like in a lot of different ways, Black women are at the forefront of starting these conversations, whether it's through activism, whether it's, you know, in the political realm, whether it's through journalism, all those things. We seem to be the loudest voices while also being the ones that are, you know, asking for the most help at the same time. So it's frustrating, but it's something that I have unfortunately had to become very used to seeing and hearing and talking about.
Hoden, I appreciate you spending some time talking with us about it today. That's Hoden Hashi, an activist with Black Boston. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Michael, I want to give you a chance just to respond there before I go to another call.
Yeah, so one, just to Hoden Hashi and Monica Cannon Grant and so many others here and across the country, thank you for your commitment to this struggle. Thank you for organizing. I know Monica. Monica's a good friend. They're getting in good trouble. This is what John Lewis talked about in the tradition of a Diane Nash or Dr. King or John Lewis and so many others. Thank you for your service in this. Two, just maybe a quick comment about the need to change laws. We're in a moment right now that there's a police reform bill in the legislature and conference committee, House 4886 and Senate 2820. That bill could come out of conference watered down, and we might not meet the moment, right? That's the challenge we have when we march in the street. You got to show up for the legislation. You got to call the members of your congressional delegation, or in this case, the legislature, and demand that the bill meet the moment, that it be a strong piece of legislation that prevents these kind of murders, that prevents police misconduct and holds law enforcement accountable. If we don't do that and we pass something that just some people can take a lap and feel like they've done something significant that's not, we should all be angry at ourselves for letting it happen.
I'd like to take another call here. We have Arlene on the line from Salem. Arlene, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I am not surprised at all by the verdict that, you know, that came down, or the lack of verdict. It is a sad day for all of us in the United States, and I really feel that. I live here in Boston. This took place in Louisville, Kentucky, but, you know, people are people, and it is a shame. It's a darn shame that we are, you know, functioning the way that we are, so, you know, pulled apart and not taking into account human beings. We are all human beings, and all lives, like our, especially Black lives, and coming from a Latino, a brown person, and I have two sons that are very dark-skinned, and I worry about them every single day.
Arlene, thanks for adding your voice. I appreciate it. And Renee, you know, we are in a moment of possible accountability here in the Commonwealth. You know, police reform is being negotiated. Michael was talking about the laws that need to be passed. How are you feeling about the police reform moment in Massachusetts in this context and in this moment?
You know, I feel like as these things go, there's all this enthusiasm. Then it actually gets onto the floor, and then it starts getting picked apart and watered down. And the police are complaining that they feel unsupported and the morale is low. And then the moment starts to fade. And I think that's what starts to happen. It's like there's all this attention, and then they kind of wait for it to quiet down and then to pass, you know, to quote a Prince lyric, something close to nothing. you know, and that's not going to meet the moment. It, you know, it wasn't going to meet the moment 3 months ago, 4 months ago now when George Floyd died. It's not going to meet the moment now. And it's not about these things that happen in these other places, because what happens there is happening here. This is one of these are national tragedies. And so I think the legislature has to get this right. And if they don't get it right, then they need to be voted out. There need to be legislators who understand what it means to meet the moment, to bring about the accountability that's been denied for decades. This is the moment to do it. And if they don't, they need to go.
So, Michael,
Tiziana, one additional point on. I want to acknowledge as activists on this airing today that, one, our prayers go out to those two officers that were shot in their vehicle. Our prayers go out to those officers who were shot recently in Louisville and others across the country. Blue lives have always mattered, right? Most Americans mourn when there's a law enforcement officer killed or first responder. That's true for most of the country. But I don't see most of the country mourning when an African-American is shot or we die at a higher rate of every disease you can think of. There are all kind of indicators that Black lives don't matter because we don't hear that same outcry. We don't see that same concern. We don't hear that same concern from our white brothers and sisters across the country. That is the problem. We know blue lives matter. We know all lives should matter. But do Black lives matter? And I think everyone has to answer that question for themselves.
Just briefly, I did an event over the weekend where I got a chance to talk to Dr. Ibram Kendi. And one of the things he did was call Boston to its abolitionist past, you know, in the 1850s, and the fiber we have to agitate for real change. Renee, do we still have that fiber among us now? And how do we mobilize it?
You know, if we don't, we need to find it. I mean, Boston gets a lot of credit because of the abolitionist movement. The abolitionist movement here, if you study it, was a little more complicated than presented. You know, there were certainly people who were anti-slavery but weren't necessarily pro-Black. So, you know, that's its own thing. But, you know, you have to come up to the moment. I don't see how Boston or any other city gets away with doing the least it can possibly do. It's the moment demands more. The citizens demand more. You know, this can't fall on the activists. I worry about Monica Shannon Grant, who I haven't met, but she's doing so much. And what this process does is it breaks your heart again and again. So the city needs to step up. The legislatures need to step up. They've got to get this done.
Renee Graham of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, thanks to you too.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Renee and Michael for continuing to have these difficult conversations with us. I know we'll keep having them, and I thank all of our listeners for calling in and engaging. That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.